Wind energy is good for cutting our carbon footprint, but it can be bad for birds and bats.
Pretty much everywhere wind turbines are installed, we see mortalities of bats.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, how people are working to harness the wind and save bats, too. Meanwhile, white nose syndrome is another threat to bats, and it's decimated populations. Still, conservationists have hope.
There's plenty of abandoned mines and plenty of railroad tunnels in Pennsylvania that we could treat that could help get the population of bats up.
Plus, puddles of melted snow and ponds that pop up with spring rains don't look like much to us.
They may appear to be these isolated little aquatic islands, but they're very important pieces of the landscape.
Just ask frogs and salamanders. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A new poll finds a majority of Pennsylvanians view climate change as a major public health risk. 51% of those surveyed in a new Muhlenberg College poll said it poses a major risk. 26% said the warming presents a minor risk, and 20% believe it poses no risk. Chris Borick directs the college's Institute of Public Opinion and says the results show more people are connecting the impacts of climate change to their everyday experiences.
In Pennsylvania, mirroring national level trends, that there's been a gradual increase, especially in the last few years, in public acceptance of the existence of climate change.
Climate-related risks to Pennsylvania include frequent extreme weather events, injury and death from those events, and threats to health through air pollution, diminished water quality, and heat stress. On Tuesday, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection ordered a pipeline company to restore streams and wetlands it illegally eliminated or altered while building a pipeline that opened last year. The Revolution Pipeline had only been working for a week when it exploded in Beaver County in September, destroying one home. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
The DEP says it only found out about the stream damage while investigating the pipeline explosion. The agency says that Energy Transfer, the pipeline's owner, illegally eliminated at least 23 streams during construction by filling them with soil. This led to a loss of nearly 1,900 feet of stream channel. Another 1,300 feet were lost when the company shortened the lengths of 120 other waterways, mostly unnamed tributaries to streams in Beaver and Butler counties. In February, the agency told the company it wouldn't review any more of its permits until it fixed erosion problems it discovered along the pipeline route. That halt, which also applies to the company's Mariner East pipeline from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia, remains in effect. The latest order mandates the company identify and repair all stream damage along the 40-mile route of the Revolution by July 30th. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
A new Penn State study shows the number of ticks that carry Lyme disease is increasing in Pennsylvania. WPSU intern Steph Crane talked to one of the study's authors.
Since 2000, Pennsylvania has had the highest number of Lyme disease cases in the country. A new study conducted by Penn State researchers suggests that number might increase. Researchers found that the black-legged tick, the most common carrier of Lyme disease, is now the dominant species of tick in the state. Assistant Research Professor Joyce Sakamoto was part of the research team that examined 117 years of tick samples. She said the shift is caused by regrowth following the clear cutting of forest more than a century ago.
More recently, as we've been reforesting, these species have come back.
Sakamoto says finding and removing ticks within 24 hours is the best way to avoid Lyme and other diseases.
The number one thing is not so much what you can do beforehand, but what you do afterwards. And that is, before you get in your car, you check yourself. And then you go home, you take a shower, and you check yourself again.
Black-legged ticks can also carry other viruses, including spotted fever and babesiosis. I'm WPSU intern Steph Crane.
Well, ticks are arachnids, and cicadas are insects. and millions of them will soon crawl out of the soil in southwestern Pennsylvania. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports this brood will stick around a few weeks before disappearing for another 17 years.
That's the call cicadas make not long after they emerge from the ground like zombies. This brood of cicadas last appeared in 2002 and is expected to come out again this month in Pittsburgh and the surrounding counties. Robert Davidson with the Carnegie Museum of Natural History says climate change makes their timing a bit unpredictable.
In the past, you could pretty much count on mid-May, and then they're usually out for about 6 weeks.
He says cicada nymphs spend 17 years underground, breaking out of their cases and forming new ones as they grow. When the soil hits 64 degrees, they're ready to come out and grip onto a tree for one final molt.
When it crawls out, it's sort of pale and soft, and the wings are all crinkled up like an origami.
The insects mate and lay eggs. While they're above ground, they are a major food source for fish and birds, and humans can eat them too.
They taste kind of like plastic and fat.
Davidson does not recommend them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Amy Sisk.
On a spring evening at the edge of a woodland or field, or maybe even your own backyard, you can hear a whole other world begin to wake up. That's if you know what to listen for.
Those are wood frogs. So you'll hear these guys calling back and forth, and then occasionally you might hear that high-pitched of a spring peeper.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we find frogs, salamanders, and other creatures in vernal pools for a limited time only. Stay tuned. When it gets warmer and the sun goes down, another animal emerges, this time in the sky. Bats. They help farmers and the rest of us by eating about a million bugs a year. That's per bat. But there are dramatically fewer bats these days than there were 10 years ago. Scientists are struggling to figure out a way to deal with the culprit, white nose syndrome. In Pennsylvania, it's pushed some species to the statewide endangered list. The northern long-eared bat, the tricolored bat, and the little brown bat were listed in January. For our series, Wild PA, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports scientists are trying a new method to keep our friends in the night sky afloat.
On a bright spring morning, about 20 biologists, researchers, and students gather around the entrance to an abandoned railroad tunnel near Dubois in central Pennsylvania. Everyone's in white Tyvek suits and rubber boots. They're gathered around Greg Turner, a biologist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission, who's previewing the day's work.
Moving through the site till we get to about the middle, and the middle is where the little brown should be on the ceiling up at the top. And we're going to grab.
The team is here to check on how little brown bats are doing. The species has been hit hard by white nose syndrome, a decade-old plague on America's bat population. This team is looking at whether a commonly used chemical can slow the epidemic. Wading into the tunnel in ankle-deep water, they get to higher ground about a quarter mile in. It's pitch black, aside from headlamps and flashlights, which reveal tiny brown creatures wedged into crevices and cracks on the tunnel walls.
So that's a little brown bat right there. And it has a little bit of a dark mask across the face there.
It's mid-March, and these bats are still hibernating. White nose attacks bats during hibernation. It disrupts their sleep pattern during winter, preventing them from storing up enough energy to survive. Turner shines his light onto clumps of bats, sometimes three or four of them piled into a small hole in the wall. Their heads are smaller than a mouse's.
So we always say like the size of an eraser on a pencil. If you have a crack that big, a bat can get in there.
White nose syndrome is caused by an invasive fungus, Pseudogymnoascus destructens, or PD. Brent Sewell is one of the lead researchers on the project. A biologist at Temple University, he says the PD fungus probably came to America from Europe or Asia around 2006.
I mean, the most likely scenario is that somehow it hitched a ride on somebody's caving gear.
European bats have a resistance to the fungus, but American bats don't. The disease has hit some species hard. Once common in Pennsylvania, the little brown bat is on the statewide endangered species list, and might be on the federal list soon.
We are just seeing massive declines, whereas you might have seen tens of thousands of bats previously. You might go to the same exact site today and only see tens.
Scientists are trying lots of things to help these bats out. Some are working on a vaccine. This group is trying something else. Last summer, they treated this abandoned railroad tunnel with the antifungal agent polyethylene glycol. It's a common non-toxic chemical found in products like toothpaste or laxatives. It doesn't kill the fungus. Instead, it tricks it into thinking there's a drought, so the fungus spreads more slowly. The idea came from a student of Barry Overton's, a biologist who studies fungi at nearby Lock Haven University. He says the treatment is just like spraying a field with insecticide.
We're not treating the bats. We're trying to lower the environmental reservoir of the pathogen.
Overton says he wants to see whether these treatments will have negative impacts on the state's native fungi. Microbial communities that live in Pennsylvania's caves have been built up over millennia. Overton says he wouldn't want to disrupt these fragile ecosystems. But tunnels like this one were only created in the last century, so they could be fair game.
There's plenty of abandoned mines and plenty of railroad tunnels in Pennsylvania that we could treat that could help get the population of bats up.
Greg Turner carries a ladder to a section of the tunnel where bats are packed into cracks and divots on the tunnel walls. He opens the ladder and climbs up, carrying a harvesting pole. It's a long, thin rod with a piece of fabric wrapped around the end of it. He nudges the bats with the fabric tip, and they grab on with their claws. He then lowers the bats onto a net held by the team below. After capturing them, the team members put the bats, still half asleep, in small paper bags to weigh and measure. At first, the bats are silent, but gradually they begin to stir, scratching at the bags with their claws. Marianne Gagnon, a PhD candidate at Temple, is helping Sewell weigh and measure the bats.
We have someone.
Little Browns, she says, are worthy of their name.
So the ones we had this morning were all between 6 and a bit above 10 grams for the little brown bats.
That's the weight of 2 pennies. She tells me to pick up one of the paper bags to see how light they are.
I don't feel like I'm holding anything.
Oh, it's really light.
There's nothing in the bag.
After each bat is weighed and measured, their wings are swabbed for a DNA test for PD. Turner and Sewell then photograph each bat using a special UV light. Turner holds each bat wing down onto the light while Sewell snaps a picture from a camera on a tripod. If there's any white nose fungus on the wing, it will glow orange under the light. The orange is actually iron being pulled from the bat by a chemical secreted by the fungus. Some of the wings have orange splotches on them, signs of white nose, but some look okay. Brent Sewell points one out to Barry Overton.
Barry, look at this wing. Never seen that this time of year.
Never seen it like that.
Mm-hmm. And a little brown.
That's exciting.
Turner says that overall, these bats look like they're doing well.
The vast majority of them seem to have less infection, kind of a rate, I'd put it equivalent to like mid-season. So they probably did have a slight delay on getting exposed, which is what we were kind of going for.
He holds one of the last bats by its wings and lets it hang until it starts flapping its wings.
Fly. Come on.
Fly. There you go.
They need a little encouragement sometimes.
The bat takes off down the dark tunnel. If all goes well, it'll leave the cave in a few weeks, safe from white nose for another summer. Turner says he'll start to analyze his data when it comes in the next few weeks. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
As if white nose syndrome wasn't bad enough, there are other threats to bats. Sometimes even when we're trying to fix an environmental problem, like carbon pollution, we cause another.
pretty much everywhere wind turbines are installed, we see mortalities of bats at those facilities.
That's Malia Bayless. She's Senior Director of Networking and Partnerships at Bat Conservation International. The organization works with conservationists, governments, and energy companies to minimize the damage of wind energy on bats. I asked her how big a problem wind energy is.
Wind energy is a relatively new threat to bats, as we've seen wind expand on the landscape. Over an 11-year period between 2000 and 2011, we had some estimates that ranged between a total of 840,000 bats to 1.6 million bats killed. And then the most recent study that we have estimates between 2 and 400,000 bats were killed in 2012. Those estimates sound high, but we expect them to become much higher. According to the Department of Energy, the wind energy capacity in the U.S. is expected to double in the next 10 years. And by 2050, the wind energy capacity is expected to be four times what it is today. And we also expect wind turbines to increase in both size and efficiency, which is basically going to allow them to capture energy at lower wind speeds. And this is going to allow for more wind development in areas of the country that currently it's not economically viable, like the southeastern United States. So not only are we going to see turbines become bigger and more efficient and more widespread across the landscape, but we're also going to quadruple the number of turbines on the landscape by 2050. And that's going to lead to a lot more bat mortalities. And the impacts to different species are pretty broad. So currently we have about 24 different species in the U.S. that we've documented have been killed by wind turbines. And of those reported, most are migratory tree roosting bats, about 78%. But within their range, Mexican free-tailed bats make up the majority of the fatalities. And that's the species that's best known for all those spectacular emergences in Central Texas, like under Congress Avenue Bridge. And there's also documented fatalities of federally endangered or threatened bats, including the endangered Indiana bat, northern long-eared bats, Hawaiian hoary bats, and lesser long-nosed bats.
What causes the bat fatalities at wind projects? What's the actual physical thing that happens?
Well, the bats are coming into the airspace of the turbine blades, and they're getting hit by the blades. And falling to the ground and dying. There was some conversation a while ago about something called barotrauma, which is a pressure differential. And so for a while, we were thinking that barotrauma contributed to some of those deaths. But upon further research, it really seems like they're just getting hit by the turbine blades as they occupy the airspace. The turbine blades look like they might be spinning fairly slowly from afar, but really the tips of those blades are spinning very fast.
Pennsylvania's Game Commission has a cooperative agreement with energy companies that operate wind turbines in the state. Is that common? Are these kinds of agreements effective?
It's not common, really. Pennsylvania is one of the few U.S. states that have explicit guidance for monitoring for all species, for bat fatalities at wind energy facilities. And they are also one of the few states to implement a threshold policy. They've set a threshold in place where if a wind energy facility kills more than 25 bats per turbine, then they have to implement conservation measures to reduce the impact. And Ontario is the other one. Ontario has a threshold policy as well. And it's really it's a somewhat experimental approach to managing the wind impacts to wildlife. And one of the things that these threshold regulations in Pennsylvania and Ontario have pointed out to us is that we really need to have more consistent ways of estimating how many bats are killed and a better way of comparing wind facilities to each other to understand why some wind energy facilities are killing a lot of bats and why other wind energy facilities aren't killing so many, even though they are in pretty close proximity to one another. So we're learning a lot about how to think about bat mortality at wind turbines from those policies that they've put in place.
Yeah, I think the threshold is 30 bats now. How does Bat Conservation International work with other groups and industry to minimize bat deaths?
Bat Conservation International is a founding member of the BWEC, which stands for the Bats and Wind Energy Cooperative. And for the past 15 years, the BWIC has been a place for wind industry and the Department of Energy and state and federal wildlife agencies and NGOs and university professors and experts to really work together to find solutions to this problem of bats being killed by wind turbines. And this group develops ideas and technologies basically to save bats from being killed and test them at real on-the-ground wind facilities. And it's been pretty effective. This collaboration has developed the only reliable tools for estimating and reducing bat fatalities that's trusted by the Fish and Wildlife Service when they negotiate with wind companies to allow developments where endangered species live.
Tell me a little bit about some of the tools that are used and how they're used.
So the most effective way to keep bats from being killed right now is to modify the way that turbine blades operate, particularly at low wind speeds. And this is called curtailment or sometimes operational minimization. And the reason it works is because bats are the most active when wind speeds are low, so on those low wind nights. And most turbines begin generating electricity between 3 or 4 meters per second. And that's called the cut-in speed. So the BWIC figured out that if we simply increase that cut-in speed a little bit, say to 5 or 6 meters per second, and then feather the turbine blades, which means to pitch them parallel to the wind, that'll keep them from spinning at those lower wind speeds when they're not producing very much electricity. If we do that, we can save about 50 to 75% of the bats from being killed because the bats don't really fly at those higher wind speeds. There's some electricity production that's lost, but by most estimates, the electricity lost is not very much, 1%. And then there's some other kinds of tools that are being tested right now. There's several kinds of bat deterrents that are being tested, and one of them is an ultrasonic acoustic deterrent, which basically means it's emitting sound above the hearing range of humans. And these are mounted on the wind turbine, and they blast a broad spectrum sound to create an uncomfortable space for the bats because it really messes with their echolocation. And these are still being tested, but the early results look pretty promising.
Malia Bayless is Senior Director of Networking and Partnerships at Bat Conservation International. According to the Pennsylvania Game Commission, new wind energy projects have dramatically dropped off in Pennsylvania because federal tax credits for the industry expired. The commission even eliminated positions it created in the early 2000s to deal with the industry. Wind projects aren't allowed on state game lands, but the commission has an agreement with energy companies operating on private property to consider how wildlife like bats and eagles will be impacted. But now that Pennsylvania's climate plan calls for an increase in renewable energy, the wind might be changing again. I'm Carol Holsapple. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Each year, ponds of water form in winter and early spring and dry up in the summer. They're called vernal pools, and they're crucial to animals, including frogs and salamanders. WPSU's Ann Danahy went on a field trip in Center County to find out what goes on after dark at these vernal pools and why they matter.
Jim Julian is taking a group through the woods on a path cut by power lines in search of vernal pools and the creatures that live there in the spring.
What I'm going to ask that if when you're walking, take a look with your flashlights. Make sure that you're looking on the ground because this is the time of year that these animals are migrating. So it's possible that we may actually see them en route to our pond.
An assistant professor of biology at Penn State Altoona, Julian has been leading the Clearwater Conservancy tours for about 15 years. As we make our way in, Julian tells the group to listen.
Those are wood frogs.
So you'll hear these guys calling back and forth, and then occasionally you might hear that high-pitched of a spring peeper.
Julian says that once there's a snowmelt and the temperatures are above 40, the animals leave where they've been hibernating to find the same pool year after year. At the pond, Julian tells us to fan out without getting our feet in the water. That's because the salamanders and frogs could be in the leaf litter.
And if you put your flashlights out under the open water, you'll get some eye shine back from the male wood frogs when they come up above water to call.
The frogs hear us at first and quiet down, so while we're waiting for them to resume their serenades, the salamanders make an appearance.
Look, we got Jeffersons and we've got spotted salamanders down in here. So once you get that search pattern for what these guys look like, they'll just be everywhere. Oh, there's a Jefferson right there. There's a Jefferson right below the spotted, right there.
Julian says it's the first time he's caught a Jefferson at the pond. It's longer than a spotted one, but not as hefty. The vernal pools, he notes, also have a rich array of aquatic insects, including diving beetles and small crustaceans called fairy shrimp. It doesn't take long for the frogs to overcome their shyness and start calling again.
Oh, I think I got a frog.
Here's the little guy that's making all that noise. One of the little guys.
Julian is holding a small male wood frog.
Listen. What you're hearing from everyone else is their typical mating call. Because they get worked up so much, occasionally a male wood frog will end up amplexing and grabbing another male wood frog. So what they have is what's called a release call, which tells them, hey, get off of my back. I'm not who you're looking for. If you can hold them just right. Slightly different vibrating kind of call to tell you, that's the wrong guy.
One animal you won't find in a vernal pool is fish, which is good. They would make lunch out of the other animals' eggs. But Julian notes vernal pools and the animals they attract are part of the food chain. As amphibians dine on the invertebrates in the vernal pool, they too become food for other creatures. Susie Yetter is Conservation Projects Coordinator at Clearwater Conservancy, which offers the field trip.
One of the biggest challenges with vernal pools is they are ephemeral. They're temporary. They tend to be very small. People completely overlook them. They don't know that they're there.
That means someone could build on or around one without even realizing it. But even with the development, the frogs and salamanders will want to take the same path. That could mean crossing roads and developments. Yetter says another challenge is that someone having a mosquito problem might blame a wetland or vernal pool and spray it with pesticides or herbicides. But taking out the predators, salamanders and caddisflies, will likely make the problem worse.
They may appear to be these isolated little aquatic islands, but they're very important pieces of the landscape, and it's important to understand how to manage them for habitat, how to keep them connected to one another and to other natural areas in the forest, and to make sure that if you're going to conserve a vernal pool, that you also focus on the upland surrounding that pool.
Nicole Delario of State College was one of the people on the outing. She said the frog chorus stood out.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't believe how it started off as one, and then everyone else joined in. That was amazing to hear that.
While there were plenty of frogs and salamanders at the vernal pool that evening, they don't stay for long. Once they've bred, they return to the woods until next year. In State College, I'm Ann Danahy.
For more of our coverage of wildlife, head to the website, alleghenyfront.org/wildpa. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at trumponearth.org. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation, the Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio, and the Robert F. Schumann Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.